check this.
The DL Debate, brought to you by the Dry Arch Complex 24-hour service station Letterkenny. We're here for all your needs.
Welcome one and all. It's episode 15 of the DL Debate. Come live, beaming out from a house here via a tie line into Highland Radio Studios, the famous Highland Radio Studios on the mountain top. Another great show coming up for you this evening. We were supposed to have John Hearn and Conal Dunn on the line here, but duty has called for our John. He can't make it. So myself and Conal is going to be taking up the show initially. And then we're moving on to the GA Director of Communications, Alan Milton, for all the inside word on Croke Park and what's happening up there with the GA. But first of all, I'm delighted to say I have my old teammate and former Donegal and St. Union's man, Conal Dunn, on the line with me. Conal, how are you?
Not too bad, Brendan. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. Fit as ever, Conal. You're always a man that looked after himself.
Well, listen, I like to, you know, we like to get out and keep fit, and you know, it's, I suppose it's keeps you going. And when you're looking at a computer all day like I do, I suppose it's good to get keep in good shape. Yeah,
healthy body, healthy mind. I like it. Tell me, Conal, you had a brilliant career. You played loads of different sport. Played with Donegal and St. Union's. A lot of fascinating times in there for you, and now you've started to make the switch into behind the scenes. It was a quick move. I was surprised when I seen you take up the treasurer role at Unions.
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose, yes. Thanks for having me on. I was waiting to be asked on about football here for a number of weeks, but I think it was well down the pecking order there, so I thought maybe there'd be a way of getting on here talking about something on my other side of my professional career. So, I suppose I had a thought over the last year, I suppose, when I was maybe taking a step back on the football end of it. At the end of the year, our treasurer stepped back, Niall Doherty. So there was a role there needed to be filled, and it was with my qualifications and with my practice, and you know, and as being an accountant, it was probably natural that maybe I felt that I had an obligation nearly to give something back to the club. I must say, when I did take it on, I probably underestimated the amount of work involved in it. I thought, you know, sure, listen, you're contributing the most to the club by you're going out and winning championships, playing football for the club, etc. And you probably do underestimate the amount of work that is done in the behind the scenes by the likes of the treasurers. It's just crazy, and you know, there's the secretaries, there's the chairpersons as well. So it is something that us as players, we really just haven't a clue about.
Yeah, you often hear that kind of people aren't prepared for what happened. They go into it, and then they get caught up in it. Then it becomes part of it every year because you have probably the same type of people down there. You get to know them, and then you probably stay in the role so long, and then people kind of need you, and there's a, I suppose there's a duty then that comes with being involved.
When you're playing, you're very, very blinkered. I would have found, you know, you would have known, you would have seen people about, you know, they're such and such and he or she does that role, or, you know, they knew something about what they did, but you didn't really think about what they were doing, and maybe it was, they were a volunteer and the amount of time they were putting in. You probably took them for granted, to be honest with you. And, certainly when I took on this role, it was a bit of a baptism of fire now in terms of just the amount of workload in it.
Yeah. And listen, I definitely don't want to bypass your career. 100%. This is what kind of led to this, because I know when we'll talk about it in a minute, you've dreamed up a package. I think you've looked at this, Conal, and you've said, right, there's far too much work here. You've come up with something. But before we get to that, my man, you obviously won a shed load of championships with St. Julian's, played for Donegal. And to me, Conal, I suppose you just were outside that loop whenever things took off with Donegal. And I often talk about you in terms of forgetting about Unions or anything like that. The way you played the game, the way you could play in many different positions and that, to me it would have suited very much how kind of Donegal played, particularly in those gym areas. And I often think if you were maybe from Leif Connell, would you have been in the Donegal setup? Like, it was a strange thing at the time to me. I couldn't understand. Now, I know there was this thing in Rory Kavanagh's book, and we went through it, where you had an injury and you landed a training, and you didn't realise this was going to be as serious as it was. Like, and it just seemed all a bit fudgy. And at the time, I suppose it didn't maybe it would have bothered you, but then everything was to come after. Then it was probably a thing that shouldn't have happened. And but it was very hard for you to defend yourself at the time, Colin. You thought you were doing the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose what happened there was, I think we were down at the All Ireland we were actually playing in the Kilmacud Sevens, believe it or not. And there was it was a tight. I think it was the Kilmacud Sevens might have been on the Saturday, and we that was an all day thing. I think we ended up getting to the semi finals of that. And there was a trial match organised for the Monday, maybe in Balbuffet, and myself and Rory were obviously down, and we stayed down for the All-Ireland the next day and had a good day, whatever, and came back up the Monday evening, and the limbs were a bit sore. It probably wouldn't have been medically the right thing to go and play a match. So myself and Rory decided that we weren't ready to play in this game, but in the trial match, unfortunately for myself, that meant that was it. There was no further trial games. It was I wasn't asked back for another trial. So in hindsight, I probably didn't push it enough in terms of, I'd been around the panel for a number of years. I was maybe concentrating on my career outside of football, and if I really had have wanted it, I probably could have pushed it and maybe tried to maybe convince Jim otherwise. But obviously with the success that they did have, in hindsight, I should have done that. But at that time, I didn't. And obviously, Rory got a slightly different treatment because of who he is. But
that's what I mean. It was so harsh, and I don't mean to throw the thing obviously on Niamh Conlon, but I just think that if there was a wee bit of a leniency given, or at least to open up a bit of dialogue with you, because listen, just knowing you as I know you, Colin, you were a brilliant trainer, you're a real great teammate, work ethic was your thing, which is everything that Donegal was in. But you know, things that get happened, Colin, and often think about Michael Hegarty. I mean, even in when Donegal won that Ulster in 2011, that was probably the goal that he wanted to get there. Like most of us at the time, he probably thought, right, that'll do me. Yeah. You know, should we want another one? I've got it now. And sure, look what happened the following year. So even at that stage, his hindsight wasn't thinking this could happen. And I suppose that sport, Colin. But outside of that, you still had a brilliant time playing sport. Right. And that's a thing that keeps coming up here. You know, it's not, I suppose, you're talking to guys like David Brady and these guys, you know, the journey and the amount of people you meet and things you do, it still was a brilliant time.
It definitely is. It's a cliche that people talk about, it's the journey. And I suppose as you get older, you do realise that. I mean, there's wins, there's losses for every sports person, every year. And it really is about the journey and the people you meet and the relationships. And you know, you bump into people 20 years later, you haven't seen them, and you talk about the games. And so I think as you get older, you do realise that that is the main thing. Obviously, it would have been nice to have that extra bit of silverware, I'm not going to lie, that's life.
Yeah. I'm on the same boat, man, don't worry about it. We'll drown the social. Talking about getting older now, where's the boots at now? Are they being polished up for the
in terms
new
of the club
season?
Well, a wise man, Charlie McGrew, once said to me, he said, you don't retire from the club, you just get dropped. So
did you say a wise man before you said there? Charlie might be listening.
I'll just listen to Charlie's advice. This was my own situation in the club. I was disappointed the way it ended last year in the club. I was available there for selection and wasn't selected, and I suppose the vibes I was getting maybe that just there were some other decisions made, and I just got the vibes that maybe I'm probably surplus to requirements at the moment. But I mean, as I say, you never retire from your club. If needed, I'm there. I'm keeping myself in decent shape. So who knows? I suppose, who knows.
Well, listen, there was a bit of an outcry, I think, from many stalwarts, particularly last year, Niamh Conlon, that we could have done with a bit of strength and a wee bit of game know-how on the pitch, Conlon. But sure, listen, there might be another wee chapter in there yet. You wouldn't know. But Colin, listen, just getting back to the new role at the club then, you came in, you looked at the treasurer, and you thought to yourself, there's too much going on here, that this could be We could quantify this a bit and make a more streamlined package. It'd be easier on everybody.
Yeah, well, I suppose often these things happen whenever you're faced with a problem yourself. So I took on the treasurer's role, and I suppose any club treasurer out there will know there's probably two roles essentially within the treasurer. There's actually nearly like the financial controller type role, which is maybe given strategic direction, putting controls in place, reporting, and that's the sort of higher level role. And then there's probably another role which is like the administrative burden, the paperwork, getting people paid, just getting things done. And that end of the role was probably the bit that I underestimated, and I didn't have the time to invest that maybe was required to do it in the way that it was previously done. So as a result of that, I suppose in my other role as in my career, you know, as an accountant and using financial systems, I would use a lot of those systems. So I've customized a cloud-based sort of bookkeeping accounting system for design now specifically for clubs that will automate and make that sort of administrative role of the treasurer almost non-existent, or certainly reduce the amount of work by and estimate about 75%, reduce the amount of work on that part of the role. And for me as a club treasurer, it's a no-brainer to use this system. And I suppose I've set it up with St Junan's and it's been working very well, and I've a couple of other clubs now using it as well. And I suppose the catalyst for me then was whenever COVID-19 hit, I suppose, and social distancing and the benefits of, you know, being mobile, having it in the cloud, really hit home. And I thought, why could other clubs not use it as well? I mean, when you think about the time involved in being a treasurer, it's hard to get people to actually take treasurer's roles on. There's costs in terms of postage and stationery and maybe losing files, just the amount of actual paperwork. So the system would be entirely paperless. You basically take a picture of an expense on your phone and it goes straight up into the system. It recognizes it. It does loads of the admin for you. You don't have to worry about carrying shoeboxes of paper around. So really that's the whole, that's the idea behind it, Brennan. It's just about saving time essentially and making the club treasurer's job easier.
Fascinating. And where can people get in contact with Conley? Can't you contact you direct, or how do
they? I've set up a new website, clubaccountsonline.com. But if people want to phone into my accountancy practice, 07491 66010, or email info@dunaccountants.com, we can give them a free demo and just to tell them what's involved. It's very cost effective. It's not that expensive, and if any club treasurers are looking to make their life easier, you know, especially now when they don't want to go around meeting people, maybe with social distancing and all that, it's a no brainer, really.
Yeah, that's brilliant, because time could be spent doing other things, as you said there, Ash, and that cost effectiveness and time effectiveness is key. And if we can cut through this and help everybody out, people can concentrate on other jobs.
Exactly. Yeah. It's, you know, the time is the big thing. You're going around trying to maybe, you know, with shoe boxes of papers and invoices, and maybe you lose one then. Whereas the benefit of this is it's all in the cloud. You're not going to, once it's there, you're not going to lose it. It's automatically backed up in the cloud. You don't have to keep all the paperwork.
So at the minute, you haven't been looking at this return to play roadmap then? You've been waiting on a... which manager's going to call me, the reserve or the first?
Exactly, yeah. No, I mean, it's interesting there. I was following it on the return to play. I mean, initially, I suppose I was surprised. I was expecting it to be maybe the county first, because I just thought with the tracing involved, it might be easier in the county. But I think it's such an evolving situation. It seems to change. I mean, if you'd have said 2 weeks ago that where we are now, then you wouldn't have believed it. So it's very difficult to make it a prediction into what's going to happen, you know, in two months' time. So things have moved quite steadily, and I suppose it's been positive. So now keeping our ears open and eyes open, I suppose, and we're listening out for what's going to happen. Whereas there's a club meeting, I know, this Thursday to discuss it, so we'll know more then.
Donegal's one of the top counties in Ireland now. Keep the foreigners out, just as it comes.
Exactly.
The thing about the stewards, Colin, just going to need stewards at the grounds. Obviously, that means that you know, the grounds can't be open. You know, people might have went out to the park, out to the practice pitch, and that can't happen until the GAA go all the way and say grounds are open, because if stewards have to be there, then somebody has to be accountable. So that's a big step in between. So it's really only organised sessions at the minute that'll be available.
Only organised sessions available, and then isn't it from August? Then there's going to be games, but whether people can be at those games, I suppose. August, a lot can happen between now and then as well, so it's just about keeping close to the pulse on it.
Yeah, and listen, the signs is good in a way. I think they'll change pretty quick. I suppose the GAA is such a massive organisation, it's everywhere. It's very hard to say, if one area is still not as safe as we are, Colin, then how do you open up it? And you have people travelling, and sure, the amount of our people, if they're going back to work in the likes of Dublin or Belfast, Galway, College or something, they're maybe going into an area then that isn't as safe as here. So I guess that's probably the fear from the GAA. It's just to be able to roll it out. I know people have said, could we not take it in different places? But of course, everybody's moving about, so it wouldn't make sense.
No, exactly.
And just on Niamh Connolly and the McGinley, there's a charity thing going around. We have to wear a jersey from someone who you've had a bit of a rough relationship with, and I've been nominated to wear a Niamh Connolly jersey. So I don't know if you have one at the house spare, do you? But I have to get one and wear it for a charity.
Oh, we had many battles over. I don't, unfortunately. Now, Niamh Connolly, we probably had many battles. They probably have a few of my jerseys from me tearing it off my back, I think. But
they were good battles, in fairness. Paddy Campbell might have won
them. You and Paddy, you swapped jerseys a few occasions, I think.
The Undertaker is right. Thanks, Evan McGinley, for that. No, listen, it's for a good cause. He's for a wee kid needs an op there. So
very good.
I'll have to dig out one of them. Maybe John Gilday's not that far away. Might have won there as well. But that's the real history. Colin, listen, thanks very much. What we'll do is we'll get that bit of information from you, your information. We'll add a link to it here as well.
Great, appreciate
about
that.
Your package. And listen, it's great, I think, Colin, that one of our own, who's a treasurer, who's an accountant, who knows his stuff now, is promoting this. So we'll ask the Donegal clubs. We'll get a send out to them as well. Give them the information. And we hope this takes off and saves everybody a lot of time and effort. And thanks for the bit of brain play in there. We need that. We need that indeed. Sir, thanks very much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks very much. And it's a great show, Brendan. I think fair play to you now. It's going well. We listen every week. So good luck.
Yep. Thanks very much. Appreciate the call. Take care. Right, folks. Now I'm delighted to say I'm joined by GAA Director of Communications, Alan Milton. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Brendan, good to talk to you. Hope you're well.
Your very best, Alan, your very best. You're up in HQ at the minute?
No, Brendan, I've only been in HQ three times in the last 11 weeks, which has been surreal. So I've a bit of an office set up at home, like everybody else. There's very few people in Croke Park, just the pitch maintenance staff and a couple of people from operations who've been helping the HSE run the test centres. So I was in for the visit of the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar and the Minister for Health, Simon Harris, and it was surreal to see the Cusickstown tunnel being used the way it is being used, and also the new handball centre, which we haven't even opened, which is being used for walk-in appointments for people getting tests. And so it's been fantastic to be able to do something for the community in North Dublin, which is ironically the highest area with COVID-19 cases, I'm told. So in a tangible way, the stadium is being used, but I think I speak for everyone when I say we'd like to see it being used for what it's normally used for, and hopefully that'll be the case in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, good man. We're testing near our own club in St Union's as well. Alan, and it seems that I'm set up the tie line from home here at the minute. We've had to, be able to work with what's going, and thankfully in certain jobs we can. And Alan, your job leading up to GAA Administrator, you were working with, you obviously a round-tower club man, handy cornerback in your day playing senior football. I don't want to put out the man's playing career as well, you know. Listen, my favourite people, the cornerbacks. But yeah, you're involved obviously in the club as well there, Alan. That's a big part of your life as well, in the executive.
Yeah, I've been involved in the committee, Brendan, since I was 23. I'm 42 now, so I played a bit of Division 9 last year, which is not all-star material, but it was great fun nonetheless. But I coach under 11s Camogie ladies football, and I was juvenile chair till last year. So look, the club, like so many other people, is... And that's what I found really difficult, is the evening times and the weekends with nothing on. But the club is the heartbeat, and I'm not sure how familiar people are, your listeners, with the GAA in Dublin, but they mightn't think that the GAA club is the focal point of the community. But I can tell you, where I live in South West Dublin and Clondalkin, if we didn't have the GAA club, we'd have a serious void in the community. So it's different to rural Ireland, but it's very, very important and plays a central role. And my daughters are playing now, and my youngest lad, Tomás, is... starting at Tower's Oak this year, so that'll be the third one in. So the house has fallen down with footballs and hurleys and gear, as you can imagine. But it's the heartbeat of the family in many ways, and it's the heartbeat of the community here. And I know there's real excitement here about getting the walkway open on Wednesday, and we've appointed a COVID officer and we've appointed a COVID working group and a lot of really good people. So I think this will be, you know, our club's not unique in that regard. There'll be 1,500 clubs will start to pulse again in the coming weeks, and think of the effect that's going to have on life around Ireland and overseas, of course. But I just can't wait to get the first game in, whatever it's Junior C or whatever it might be. It'll be just fantastic to get up and see the pitch, which is immaculate, and it's been kept pristinely by our volunteers up there.
And how do you see that? How do you see it evolving then? It's going to have to be, you know, training. It's going to be organised training first, Alan, and the pitches can't be open unless there's club stewards there to oversee that.
Yeah, this all comes down, Brennan, to the government requirement for test and trace. So what we're going back to is not what we left. And there's going to be a degree, there's going to be work here for clubs. They're going to have to get even more organised than they were previously. But what's going to happen is the club is going to have to appoint a COVID officer for the entire club, and then there'll be a COVID liaison person for each team. So what we're trying to work on at the moment is that everybody that comes will either have filed small document online before they come training, or they'll come and present a hard copy of that to their COVID rep. But you'll have to take your temperature at home or when you arrive, and you'll have to have explained that you don't have any symptoms and you haven't been out of your circle, or you hear the people I've met. It's a very short checklist which is being finalised as we speak. But I think for the first few weeks back, it'll be different and it'll be unusual. But I think people, like GA people, are very adaptable. Look how they adapted to, you know, all the work that they did when there were no games. And I think they'll embrace this with relish, because it means we can get back to what we love doing, and that's playing the games. And at the start, it'll be, imagine, aerobic, and it'll be skills-based, and it'll be a lot of running. And then, hopefully, obviously, as the contact date looms, then we get back into what we know best, and that's playing the games. And it's a new departure for everybody, but it's not just the GAA, Brennan. If you get on a bus to go into Dublin City Centre, or you go to Tesco's, or whatever you do, everything in life has changed, and it's going to remain different for the foreseeable future. And if we want to get back doing what we do, we have to comply with the new way of doing things.
Sure. And supporters, how do you envisage that playing out, Alan?
I don't think that's going to be a problem, Brennan, for clubs, because the numbers, like, we did some research on this at the start of it, and we reckoned very few club fixtures. Even, for example, County Final in Mayo, very few fixtures in the club arena breach 5,000. Now, some of the bigger ones will, but we won't have to worry about that at the start, because people are going back at local level. Now, I was joking to somebody recently, when the first match is on in the locality, I'm sure there'll be a huge crowd at it, but yeah, it's easier to social distance when the crowds are smaller. And, you know, I think people are doing this of their own volition, so when they turn up at anything now, even they're in company or you meet someone in the park, you know, you're staying 2 metres away. And I think especially people who might be a little bit more senior or might have underlying conditions, they're going to adhere to best practice, because A, it's going to keep them safe, and B, it's going to keep the other people safe. So look, it's very abnormal. There's no shaking hands, there's no hugging, and I don't know how the French and the Italians are going to get on with no kissing and all the rest of it when they meet in the street. But it's just, these are the things we just have to do, and I don't envisage a major problem for club crowds. I think we'll be having a different discussion when we get the inter-county game back up and running, there's no doubt about that, but we've a lot of time to get our heads around that, and that work has already started.
Yes, yes, just take it easy on the
days Christmas in Clonus will be very different for you, Brendan.
Yeah.
Going up the hill.
But us Donegal boys kissing the Tyrone boys will be out of line for a while. That's all right, Alan, no problem. Alan, I was just looking there. You were a journalist for 10 years now. Quite a strange move for a journal to become a GAA administrator. You know, I've seen a quote there, poacher turned gamekeeper.
Yeah.
Alan, how did that all come about? Because that's where I first met you. In particular, I would obviously spoke to you on the phone when you worked for the Sun, and we got on the best, and you ended up coming with us in 2001 on that very memorable tour. We had Pat McEnany on there the other week having a yarn there, so that's where I first really got to know Pat as well, and friends now to then. Same with yourself, every time I see you up at Croke Park, always great to see you. You have a mobile in one hand, walkie-talkie in the other, and if I get 10 seconds with you without somebody calling you or needing you, Alan, that would be the height of it, you know.
A privilege to work in there. I studied Irish and history in UCD, Brendan, and a lot of my friends went on to teach, and I always had an inkling about journalism. When I realised I wasn't going to play at the highest level like you did, the next best thing, as I saw it, was to be as close to the games as possible. And I did a Masters in Journalism in DCU, and I got a placement with the Star, which lasted 3 months, and they kept me on for another 3 months. And then I ended up in the Indo for about a year and a half before a big job came up in the Sun, which you know, I travelled the world and I travelled all over Ireland covering Gaelic games. What was not to love about that? And after 8 years, a job came up in Croke Park as communications manager, and I felt, you know, after, you know, every 7 or 8 years, and this is just a personal thing, that you either have to, you know, move or adapt or do something new in your life, and Croke Park only comes calling once, as I saw it in my head. So I went for the job, and it's not as uncommon as you might think. A lot of journalists do enter communications and PR because they have experience in writing and they understand how the media works. So if you look across the other sporting organisations, there'll be a fair few journalists. I wasn't to know that journalism was going to take on a very difficult period, especially print journalism, the area I was in, because the sales of newspapers has just plummeted. I don't take any pride or pleasure in saying that, because I'm still a newspaper man and I love to have the paper in my hands, or the digital copy, whatever it might be. But yeah, getting the job at the Sun really catapulted me in terms of opportunities and profile. And I remember that trip, Brendan. I went from covering under 10 games out in Lucan for the Herald to going to Australia within 8 months. You know, it was a huge, huge opportunity for me. And I remember you being top scorer that year, if I'm not mistaken, and having an argument with my good friend.
I wasn't going to bring that up.
Yeah, I thought you might. My friend Martin Brenny in the Indo and myself were had a great laugh over that, because I knew you were suited to that game. And I'm a big fan of the hybrid game. And I remember Mr. Brian McAniff playing the piano one night at all hours in the hotel in Melbourne. He couldn't sleep. And we had a great... he asked us who we'd pick for the second game, I think it was. And, you know, there was a great camaraderie with the players. In those days, as you recall, you could ring players. It was different. You know, the media wasn't as... it wasn't as demanding, because there weren't as many platforms and there was no social media. So the other thing as well is I used to ring some of the Dublin lads who I would have known from the club scene in Dublin from playing against them. So it was just different. I suppose, look, it's 20 years ago. Why wouldn't it be different? But look, when the job came up in Croke Park, I just thought to myself, I can't not go for this. And I've loved every minute of it. And it's a demanding job. And there's a lot of scrutiny on the GAA as an organisation, because people expect high standards of it. But I like to think most of the time we put our best foot forward. Do we get it right all of the time? No, we don't. I don't know anyone who does. But I've been particularly happy about the growth of our digital channels, and we've got some really good people working on the team in Croke Park. And of course, I can't not mention the PRO networks around the country, like people like John McAniff and Donegal, all who are tireless volunteers, because we've a team of 8 people in Croke Park, Brennan, but it can't work without the 32 county volunteers who act as PROs, and also the PROs in all of our clubs around the country, some of whom do outstanding work and are every bit as efficient, in, despite the fact that they're volunteers. They're as up to speed in the technology and are as passionate about what they do as any of the paid officials in Croke Park, or indeed anywhere else around the country.
Yeah, and you know what, Dan, right down the line, you know, when I go up there, you know, the stewards, or when we go up doing covering games, the press, everybody that's in there, there's such a great vibe, there's such great people, you know, it's such a brilliant part of it. Every time you go up there, you see the same people. And
it's a very special place to work, Brendan. Yeah. Like, you know, I don't know about you, but on All-Ireland Day, when the four strains of Aran Naveen are played, you know, that's a quintessentially Irish moment in my head. And if I wasn't paid to be there as a paid employee, I'd be there anyway. And I just think it's a very, very special place. And I've watched All-Ireland finals from abroad, and no matter where you are in the world with Irish people, it's really, really poignant. And I often describe it as being like second St. Patrick's Day, because Irish people congregate to watch the All-Ireland final the same way lots of people here watch the Super Bowl. And I just think those days, well, they're not the ordinary nuts and bolts stuff that we do every day with the club, but there are showcase occasions where everybody stands to attention for the national anthem. It doesn't matter who's playing in the All-Ireland final. If your own county's there, even better. But if they're not, it's still a day when, you know, there isn't its equivalent anywhere, where 30 amateur, volunteer, elite athletes take to the field and have prepared as diligently as the guys have, you know, and all for the pride of where they come from. That's a really, really special dynamic in the GAA, and it's something everybody who works in Croke Park is very, very aware of.
Yeah, it's interesting, Alan, you mentioned the Super Bowl. If you look at other sports around the world, no matter what it is, basketball, American football, soccer, there's no place that comes together like Croke Park. There's nowhere as special. I mean, for a time, I think, in England, Wembley probably had something when the FA Cup was as big. Of course, the FA Cup isn't as big now, so there isn't this thing where the whole country is focused in on one stadium the way everybody wants to be at Croke Park. And going back, Alan, just looking at the history of it, you know, going way back into, you know, the first GAA games being played there, which come back into 1891, you know, the old Butterley's Field, which would become the Jones's Road. Gaelic GA Athletics meeting. Funny, athletics was in the title at that time, Alan, which was something which was mixed up at the very start within the hurling, handball and the football.
Yeah, Michael Cusick would have been very big in that space, and he would have, I think it was shot put was his area of expertise, but the, you know, codified sport in Ireland was very rare, Brendan, and I think there was a concern. If you ever read the official guide, there's a really interesting letter from Archbishop Croke as to the growth of, as they saw it, foreign games, and cricket had become popular, and it had become popular in counties, ironically, that later became really good at hurling in Kilkenny and Tipperary and places like this. So I think they felt they were going to get left behind if they didn't codify games that Irish people could play, and that were ours, uniquely ours. And you've often heard of the histories of football and hurling where it was semi-chaotic, where one village would play against the other and, you know, it would turn into chaos and people would get injured. So it had become quite fashionable to try and codify sports. And I suppose when it took off, there was a famous analogy that the GAA, the popularity of it spread like a prairie fire, because it's based on what makes it successful today, is that if your club next door to you gets a new pitch or is successful at something, well, people in your club want to match them or better them, and that's exactly how the GAA works, because we're all comparing ourselves against the next club and your rivals, and it's the lifeblood of it is that you want to stay up with the Joneses, and you want to better them, and you want to, like, from facilities to achievements to the setup in a club, and the thing just spread around the country. And of course, when it got that popular, there had to be a headquarters, and Frank Dineen was the man who purchased Croke Park on behalf of the GAA and eventually handed it over to the GAA in 1913. But they were very turbulent years, as you can imagine, around that time, especially what was to come immediately afterwards. And I was saying to someone recently, probably the recent COVID lockdown, its most challenging period before that was probably around the time of the emergence of the state, which is in the teens, and the War of Independence and the Civil War. So the GAA has been through a lot, and it's been with us, obviously, since 1884. So in many ways, it's been linked to the emergence of modern Ireland, and I'm glad to say I don't think the games have ever been more popular in terms of the number who play them, or indeed the numbers who go and watch them. And I'd like to think if we were lucky to be here in 30 or 40 years, Brendan, that it'll still occupy the same central role that it does in Irish life, because it's something we grow up doing. And I think the litmus test for me around All-Ireland Day, and you mentioned All-Ireland Day, is the amount of overseas journalists that look for access to come and see, because the word is out there thanks to technology. So it was really hard 20 years ago, 30 years ago, to explain to somebody overseas what the All-Ireland final was, but now you can send them a link on YouTube, and technology has been a real enabler in that regard. And when you see Croke Park, why wouldn't you be proud of it? And it's not just Croke Park, like, look at Park of Creeve, or you look at Semple Stadium, or our stadiums in every county. And that's before we even mentioned the club facilities. It really is a movement, and I suppose the GAA has provided the country with a network of sporting facilities that otherwise wouldn't exist, because as a country we did not overinvest in sport. If you go to France or Australia and you see the facilities they have, we don't have those facilities here, and we would have a whole lot less if it wasn't for the GAA.
Yeah, and I think, I suppose, looking at other sports, particularly, you know, that Irish people are in the soccer across the water and that, and I think the passion that you have for your own county can never be replicated in a club where anybody can play for anybody, and so much money involved in that. And I think as that goes on, you know, it's elevating a lot of our county players into these real heroes, because, you know, they're your own county men, and that's the way it's going to be. I think that's a huge advantage we have over the other teams. And go back, you're right in the history there, going right back. First final was 1896, played at Jones's Road. Interestingly, looking at it, Tipperary won both the football and the hurling that day. A sign of things to come, beating Kilkenny and actually beating Meath in the final. 1903, the only time All-Ireland was won by a team from outside the 32, London Emmets, beating Cork in the hurling final. And actually most of the London players were from Cork, which was interesting then. And as you said, 1908, Frank Dineen stepped in to purchase and was later to say, he bought it for £3,250, but he sold it on for £2,400. Was he doing the GAA a favour at the time, Al?
Yeah, well, he was another man, and it's hard to believe he wasn't recognised by the name of a stand after him until quite recently. They named the Canal End after, which is now the Dineen, the Davin, the Dineen End down at Hill 16. So he was obviously doing the GAA a favour at the time, and like, those figures don't sound large to me and you now, but they were considerable at the time. So I think Croke Park, once they had its own home, then you could start to generate finances to invest in the growth of the organisation. And then, of course, and we're getting to it this year, Brendan, we'll have the 100th anniversary of Bloody Sunday this year. I'm of the view that once that event took place in Croke Park, that the GAA was never going to leave Croke Park, because it's not just a stadium, it's more than a stadium, and it's a spiritual home of the GAA. Obviously, Turles is the birthplace of the GAA, which is equally as important, but I suppose Croke Park is the place we all have so many happy memories. It's sort of like the nation's playground, isn't it? So many of our good memories that we have are based in Croke Park, and indeed some disappointments too, of course, but the fact that it's a 20-minute walk or less from O'Connell Street makes it really unique. I don't think you could compare it if we'd gone to a Greenfield site. Like, they knocked down the Cusack Stand in 1993 after Derry had beaten Cork in the All-Ireland Final, and the stadium was transformed over the next 8 years. But they never missed an All-Ireland Final. Such was the way that they scheduled the reconstruction around championship games. It was a remarkable achievement for an amateur organisation, and I think it stood the test of time, and I think it will continue to do so.
Yeah, and listen, poignant, as you said, the anniversary of 1920 coming up, 13 spectators, and Michael Hogan, a footballer on the pitch, murdered by the British. 1926, first live commentary of a field sport in Europe. Quite a thing that to pull off. A Cork man, P.D. Meehan, covered the All-Ireland hurling final between Kilkenny and Galway. You know, remarkable that when you think about the sport around the whole of Europe and what a small country we were, for that to happen in Ireland. Another milestone for the country.
Yeah, and it was on a station called 2RN, and I suppose it gave rise to the birth of a very special relationship between the media and Gaelic games, because look what came afterwards in the subsequent years with Micheál O'Hare and then later Micheál Ó Muirchertach. And, you know, when people didn't have televisions or they didn't have a means to get to the ground, they hung on every word that was uttered. So it was remarkable, as you say, that Ireland would have, and our games would have ended up being the first broadcast. And I suppose there was a link between, there was a fascination with radio in this country. I know some of the earlier transmissions cross Atlantic, the first place that they were obviously going to land when they came that from America was here. So it's something that fascinates me to this day. And even when you go to Croke Park, and I know you do be providing co-commentary sometimes, but you'll see people, especially older people, with the old radio or the wireless, as my grandmother would have called it, held up to their ear while they're watching the match in front of them. And sometimes it's commentary from the match in front of them, but sometimes it's commentary from a match elsewhere. And they just go hand in hand. And it's not just radio, but like the consumption. I've often asked people, why do you think we don't have sports magazines in Ireland, really? And we don't. They're few and far between. It's because the newspapers cover our games so well. We have such a high level of local media, albeit it has receded in the last number of years. But if you think about it, there's pages upon pages in newspapers at local level and national level covering Gaelic games. And I'm not sure if there's space for magazines, and there's no other way of explaining it, because the coverage of our games is phenomenal, and it really complements the attraction, and what makes people go and watch them is the commentary around them, and sometimes the controversies or the debates or the speculation or whatever it is. Like, from the months of May to September, the county game obviously takes main focus around the place, and not just in Ireland anymore, it's gone increasingly international. But I think you'd have to doff your cap and admire some of the coverage, and some of the writing around our games is absolutely top notch.
Yeah, the debate is huge, and I just think that's the love coming through from everybody's got opinions and wants to know who's saying what. And just going back to 1933, us Ulster boys finally got on the board with an All-Ireland one. The Cavan men came down and showed us how to play ball. 45,000 at that. You know, you think about back then, you know, trains obviously were the vital thing, taking people to stadiums, you know, 1936, 45,000, big crowd, you know, and finally Ulster made its debut. And a few years later, then we had the Cusack Stand was opened, the largest stand of its type in Europe at the time. Again, you know, huge milestone for the GAA and the work that's done from what was an amateur organisation.
Yeah, there's never been a lack of ambition, Brendan. In 1959, then, the Hogan Stand, when it was built, which was the old Hogan Stand before the current one, it was the largest of its kind in the country, the largest construction. So, you know, I don't think, like, if you say the word amateur when you're in America, sometimes it denotes negativity or something not being done to a high standard. It means something totally different here. Just because players aren't paid in our sports doesn't mean to say that the organisation and indeed the players themselves don't have ambitions to be the best they can be. And that's the same on and off the field. And, look, I get to travel around to watch sport. I love all sports, and I don't know if I've ever been in a stadium. Well, I've been in some of them that rival it, but Croke Park, when it's full and it's rocking, is a very, very special place. And when they went to build it in its current incarnation, they studied they studied stadiums in America and in Europe, and what they came up with was a hybrid model in essence. So it had the best of both worlds, but it's a very, very storied history. And if you chart it back, as you say, from 1934, it's really, really served the GAA well. And I'm always conscious of being Croke Park centric, because Croke Park is not the GAA, it's only one small element of it, but every organisation has to have a headquarters, and I think it's right and proper that it should be looked after the way it has been looked after and invested in. And it'll be very interesting to see what the next phase in that might be, even if it's a couple of decades down the road.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. You mentioned Michael O'Hare. 38 was his first commentary. He's 18 years old, which is fascinating. I didn't realize he was so young when he started there, just looking back at the history. You know, whoever gave him the job, they knew what they were doing, but...
Wouldn't happen today, Brendan, would it?
And 18, can you imagine? No, 18
year old, it was remarkable.
Getting the mic to do a big game, doing an All-Ireland final. Fascinating stuff, but of course, it was the right decision.
Well, he just had an incredible way with words, didn't he? And he had an incredible flow, and also, I think he's across horse racing too, but we've been absolutely blessed in that regard, and I think he galvanised, or he entranced a couple of generations of Gaelic Games followers, and I think some of the love that people had, there was never a bad game. When Micheál O'Hare was commentating, it was always exciting, even if it wasn't exciting, because of the way he relayed it over the airwaves. And then for Micheál O'Hare to be followed with Micheál Mar Hertig, who I'm sure you've met numerous times in the media centre in Croke Park, we really had two die-ends, not just of Irish journalism, Brendan, but of world sporting broadcasts, I'd say, because the quality of what they did. And I have a particular graph for Micheál's ability to jump from Berle to Gaeilge, August Arashirish. He just has an incredible command, and he's hale and hearty, and I love to see him in Croke Park. But obviously, he would have taken some of his influences, I'd imagine, although I've never spoken to him about it, from Micheál O'Hare, because you know, the bar was raised and the popularity of the games was definitely raised, and this was all before we entered the televisual era, which brought it on again to another level.
Yeah, he was brilliant. I remember doing a few talk nights with Micheál, and you know, when he talked, time seems to kind of stand still.
Yeah, it's melodic. You start to forget what he's saying, and you get lost in the sounds.
At these nights, you know, where you have to come out with a very good point, you get a wee ripple of applause. But every
it's
time,
the famous story, Brendan, of a Scottish linguist was on holiday in Ireland, seemingly about 15 or 20 years ago, and he was driving around Munster somewhere on a scorching hot day, and there was a championship match on the radio, and he stumbled across this commentary and had to pull the car over and just sit there and listen to it. He didn't know what he was listening to. But he just said he'd never heard anything being recounted or regaled the way Micheál was commentating. And like, some of his stuff is still, it's gold. And it'll enter the annals of the GAA Museum and our folklore, because some of his phraseologies, as we all know, with Fiji and Sean O'Gahalpin and the rabbits and foxes and what have you. But as I say, his ability to jump from one language to the next as well always really entranced me. And it's something that it's not easy done. It's not something I've ever done, actually, and I know you're closer to it than I am, but it's a skill. And to know every player and to know how they run and what they look like and what foot they kick off, and you know, it's just an incredible innate ability to have, and obviously something he worked very, very hard on over a long number of years.
Yeah, and interestingly, Alan, he was in that tour as well, 2001.
We had a right motley crew that year, Brendan, if I'm not mistaken. That was my first ever away trip with the press corps, and it was a stern test, let's say.
Yeah. It tested us all right. Alan, yeah, just coming up then to the big revamp. I made my debut in Croke Park in 1998, and it was the old stadium. What year did it turn? What year was the major work done then? Was it
well, the Cusick stand was taken down. The first Cusick stand was taken down in 1993 after the final, which Derry won. Yeah. And then they moved around the ground stage by stage. So it was completed with the New Hill 16 and in 2002, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So all told, took 9 years to do, which was a phenomenal undertaking, really, because what came afterwards, what we have now, doesn't resemble in any way what went before. And it all can be traced back, Brendan, to the All-Ireland final of 1983 when Dublin played Galway in the football. Right. And it was it depends whether you're from Dublin or Galway, whether you call them the 12 Apostles or the Dirty Dozen. But Dublin won the All-Ireland very narrowly that year with 12 players, but there was almost a crush at the back of the hill. And I don't know if you were ever on the All Hill 16, but yeah, my father would have taken me there. There was really steep stairs and grassy slopes at the back, which people used to slide down, and you just wouldn't see it today in a sports stadium. But that, you know, that that alerted the authorities really that there had come a time and there was now a need to do something with the stadium. And albeit it took a long time, obviously, to get the finance in place, the Ireland of the 80s was very, very different to the Ireland of these current times. Albeit now we have our own challenges, but what we've had, what we have now, I suppose the people who were steering the ship at the time, people like Lee Mulvihill and Peter Quinn, deserve great plaudits, because it has, like, when you think about the success of the stadium, feeds back into the GAA every year. There's a dividend that goes back into the GAA, which is reinvested in other facilities or coaching initiatives or the employment of coaches or whatever. And that's something that, you know, you could never have imagined back in 1983 or 1993 when the first thought was turned for the new Cusack stand.
Yeah, yeah. And Alan, just taking us up now to day-to-day at Croke Park, how many people's involved day-to-day, and then how does that work then on match day, particularly big match day, the likes of your All-Ireland finals and that? What is the logistics about people coming in and how it all works?
Well, there's about 150 people, Brendan, work in Croke Park. Now, not all of them work for the GAA. The stadium is run as a separate entity, obviously, because it's a commercial operation. So any day you go into Croke Park, there'll be conferences and banqueting and all sorts of stuff happening in there that's non-sports related. So it's probably a fairly even split between the Croke Park stadium team and the GAA team who make the GAA function from HQ or work with the counties to make it function. But on a match day, it's a totally different ball game. So on All-Ireland final day, football or hurling, you could have as many as 2,500 staff working there. So that would include all your kitchen and service staff, your volunteer stewards. There'd be about 300 volunteer stewards, guards, and then all the different departments around the stadium. So it's a huge, huge undertaking. And that's obviously the pinnacle in terms of attendance, but it's a very, very special place to work on All-Ireland final day, because the energy and everyone's on a buzz. And then obviously last year we had, in recent years we've had a lot of replays because they weren't that common previously, especially in hurling, and then they started to come along. It's like waiting on a bus, isn't it? We hadn't had a replay, if I wasn't mistaken, going back to 1959 in hurling, and then 2012 broke that, and then they started to come ticking fast. So yeah, it's a huge operational undertaking. And I suppose the most important thing, Brendan, is we have a pre-event meeting every Thursday where there could be up to 40 people at the meeting with the guards, St. John's Ambulance and various different medics. And everything at that pre-event meeting is planned to within an inch of its life. So you have sight of whatever your other department is doing. And if it doesn't go through the prism of that meeting on a Thursday, it pretty much doesn't happen on a Sunday. So it's, you know, Peter McKenna and the stadium team deserve great credit because they run that stadium to the highest possible standards, and every eventuality is looked at. And we have an excellent working relationship with An Garda Síochána, because when you've got that many people, like in any given year, there can be over a million people come into the stadium between games and concerts and then regular day-to-day activity. So it's a phenomenal, phenomenal statistic when you put it on paper.
Yeah, Alan, you just mentioned streamlining the media there. How do you actually decide who gets what? Because I presume there's more media wants to get in than get in. How do you make that decision?
It's a good question, Brian. At the start of the year, we have an accreditation process. So we would issue about 700 press passes every year, or media passes, and there'll be some at local level and there'll be some at national level. But we never have enough on All-Ireland final day. But what you do is you give precedence to the local newspapers. So say Donegal were playing Mayo in the All-Ireland final, obviously Donegal News and Highland Radio are going to be involved with that, and the same in Mayo. And thereafter, if you've got any capacity, you try and cater for maybe counties that they might spill over into. But realistically, like if you pick up the paper on a Monday morning after the All-Ireland and there's 15 pages in the Examiner or the Irish News, you know, you have to facilitate journalists if you expect them to cover your games. So we're very lucky to have a press box that holds more than 100 people. So that doesn't include, obviously, the other people working on television and in the outside broadcast units or down on the touchline. So you could have easily have 200 people working in the media alone on All-Ireland Day. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the international interest in the games has never been higher too. So you'd love to see, and I personally would love to see, the government or the Department of Tourism marketing the All-Ireland Final as something that, you know, Irish people abroad could help us champion. But if you come to Ireland, I think it's a sin if you don't get to see a hurling or a football match. Like, it should be something that you're told is worth doing, and it's reasonable enough to do. The games are short. I happen to be biased and think the games are the best in the world. You know, what's not to love about going to a match? And it doesn't have to be a county match. It could be a club match anywhere in Ireland on any given night. Ordinarily, except at this moment in time, there'd be a match on for someone to go and see. And if you've ever gone to a match with people from New Zealand or America who've never seen hurling, the first 5 minutes is a sight to behold, because they just can't get their heads around it. And the other thing, Brendan, that we take for granted is not having any segregation in the stadium. So, you know, you might get into heated words with someone that's sitting beside you during the match, but afterwards, generally speaking, people will shake hands and possibly go for a pint inside. That doesn't happen in every sport, and it's something we should never take for granted.
Yeah, huge side of it, Alan. Yeah, that's one of the brilliant things about the GAA. Alan, I'm just going to say the foreign sports, obviously the rugby and the soccer that was played there, I thought it was fantastic to see and really showing off our stadium as well, and what a fascinating time that was for Irish sport. The pitch around those times was being relayed now. Is that still the case now? You never hear so much about it. At the time, there's a lot of talk about the pitch and relaying it and that, and about where the sod came from. What's the name of the pitch now?
Really interesting question. We used to have what was called a Deso pitch in Croke Park, Brendan, and what it had was, there was a sort of a plastic, it was a plastic mesh, if you like, and the seeds and the grass used to grow up through it, and it would help it lock it down. So obviously it was a new pitch and they were trying these things, but now it's a very different, it's a natural pitch, and Stuart Wilson, who formerly worked at the Emirates, and his team deserve great credit, because what they've done in there is phenomenal. Like, our games are different in that on a match day, our game could have three or four matches on it, whereas a Premier League game might get a game every 2 weeks or every 10 days. There's no comparing them. So the punishment their pitch gets is phenomenal. And not only do they manage Croke Park, but they manage Abbottstown, which is the facility on the National Sports Campus, which is used round the clock. And you may be aware that the GAA acquired a farm in North County Dublin, and the reason they've acquired the farm is because what we've had to do is, when we're relaying the pitch, is we had to import grass from England. Now, God forbid something was to happen with the shipping or with weather or strikes or whatever, and that was to be delayed, we'd be in real jeopardy. So sometimes the pitch after concerts might be relayed on a Monday and will be played on the following weekend, and that comes in rolls. So now what we've done is the stadium team have a farm in North County Dublin where the grass is being grown, the right type of grass they want, in very similar conditions to Croke Park. And they hope to be able to help supply counties if they want to replace goal mounts and stuff, and perhaps other sports as well. But it's a real, it's another sign of the innovation that's brought to bear on what's a science. Like, if you saw the attention to detail on the moisture tests and wind tests and bounceability and all the rest of it that's done, it's a real science, and that's the level of attention that's brought to bear. And it has to be, because, as you know, if it's not right, we hear about it. People care about that pitch, and it has to be right for the players that go out on it.
Yeah, and listen, Alan, I know all about that mesh early on. We were playing Dublin, and I think, I don't know what year it was, might have been 2002. I slid in for a ball early on, and that ripped the leg. And I remember coming on at half time. And,
was that the match you drew, Brendan, or the replay?
Well, not going to the story, but I remember Mickey Moore was giving his half time talk, and your boy hit me with the disinfectant spray, you know? And I let a roar out of me, and I remember Mickey Moore going, "What?" I nearly shook the place. And I was managing a wood floor place in Letterkenny at the time. I had to wear shorts for a couple of weeks.
I'd say it was
The mesh, I know all about that mesh, Alan, good man. But Alan, just a quick one, Alan, I'll not keep you much longer, and appreciate so brilliant information there around the ground. Now, just finances at the minute, Alan, I think a lot of people around the country think Croke Park is this like pot of gold. You know, with the minute and the lockdown, obviously, is there still money owed to the bank? You know, there's obviously fees and different things, overheads, that the bills are coming in. So at the minute, you know, Croke Park itself as a stadium, is everything's paid for, or how is the finances at the moment?
Yeah, the stadium is paid and it generates money, but, like, I'm glad you mentioned it, and sometimes there's a perception that there's a pot of gold under the pitch in Croke Park, and it's simply not true. Whatever comes in, 84% of it is redistributed to either the counties, provinces or the clubs, and it's you know, this has been a really challenging time for everybody, and look, there's people suffering more than we are. Obviously, the people have lost jobs and lost loved ones and everything, but like, staff in Croke Park have had pay cuts too, and that's just the world we're living in at the moment. So, you know, that probably wouldn't have happened if there was largesse or there was lots of money floating around. The reality is we were a games organisation with no games at the minute, and the estimation was, if there was no fixtures at all for the rest of the calendar year, that the GAA would lose 60 million. So all that means is that there won't be, you know, large infrastructural projects outside Croke Park. Like, for example, Casement Park might be the next one on the horizon, but I know there are plans in Kildare, Meath and Waterford to upgrade their county grounds. That the assistance from Croke Park for those projects is going to be more challenging now, because it's just a very, very different horizon. So I think it's really important that every time somebody comes to a match, they realise where the money goes, and we've really tried to ramp up that messaging around it. Like in my own club, when we developed our complex, we got two separate grants from the Leinster Council, and that's part of the same. It's part of the same financial assistance that comes from Croke Park. It's channeled through the provinces, and if you've had developments in St Eunan's, I'm sure it's the same via the Ulster Council. So it's not that the GA doesn't exist to make money; it has to pay its bills. You can't expand or you can't grow the organisation and you can't meet your ambitions if you don't have finance behind you to do it. But it's not, you don't wake up in the morning wondering how can you make more money today. If we don't have games, and that's our raison d'etre, and it's why we exist, it's for games and culture. And it's really important that everybody remains mindful of that. And I think most people that work for the GA know how privileged they are, but know that we serve the volunteers. We're there to complement the work they do, and we're lucky to be part of the full-time staff. There needs to be that framework because the organisation's just got so big.
Yeah, and very important, Alan. I think that information needs to get out a wee bit more, because I think people see big match day gate receipts, big deals being done, you know, around sponsorship, and they think there's this cash coming in that's somehow held at Croke Park, whatever it's going to be held there for, I don't know.
Yeah,
what
you asked me, Brendan, earlier on how many people work in Croke Park, and it's 150, but there's 600 people employed around Ireland, and abroad actually, but mostly in Ireland, that are either employed from central level GAA or partially from central level GAA. So that's a network of 600 people that make the organisation tick in every corner of the island. So it's, you know, that has to be paid for. That's a considerable bill. So we've got to be realistic as well. You have your bills to pay. It's no more than your household. You have to plan, and you have to meet your commitments in that regard. So yeah, look, there have been some very tough conversations in recent weeks. Hopefully, I think everyone's seeing light at the end of the tunnel. Hopefully, we can get back to normal and get back to what we normally do and what we normally talk about.
Now listen, Alan, that has been first class. Fascinating talking to you. Alan, that's a super job you do there. It's a busy job, and you're top class at it. And thanks so much for sharing that information with us all here on the DL Debate this evening.
Anytime, Brendan. It's great to talk to you, and I look forward to seeing you in Croke Park. Hopefully sooner. You'll be wrapped up this year, though, I think, if we get to Croke Park.
Just don't forget about being there press passes now. I know things is tight, but you make sure the venue's all there, Alan.
Take care of yourself, Brendan.
Take care, Alan. Right, folks, that's a wrap again. Thanks very much to Kenneth for producing at Highland Radio, and thanks to my guests, Conal Dunn and Alan Milton. Special message going out to Sacha, going through a bit of treatment. We're all behind you. Next week on the show, we have the one and only 92 hero Tony Boyle coming on to talk about his life in GAA. A special thanks to Kieran Brogan and all the Dry Arts for sponsoring. I'll talk to you next week.
The DL Debate, brought to you by the Dry Arts Complex 24-hour service station, Letterkenny. We're here for all your needs.